with dazzle the air. We're here cause we care. We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're dads on the air. We're back with dads on the air.
Welcome back to Dads on the Air, this 27th day of July 2010. It's a bright and sunny day in Sydney once again. And this is Bill Cable from Mediate Now, one of the dads on the air. And with me in the studio is our own Ian Purdy from ianpurdy.com.
Yes, good morning, everybody.
And also with us is Phil York from Dads in Distress.
Good morning, everyone.
Well, on today's show, we're going to be speaking to Samantha Page, who is the Executive Director of Family Relationship Services Australia. And we've got a lot to talk to her about the family relationship centres throughout Australia. And we'll also be speaking to John Flanagan, who is the Deputy Registered Officer of the Non-Custodial Parents Party, Equal Parenting. And John's party is standing in the federal election that's coming up in 3 weeks, Saturday the 21st of August 2010, there will be the federal election that we've all been hearing about, and it's been in the news this week with the debate between the leaders, and I'm sure we'll get an interesting approach to the election from John as a representative of his party, the Non-Custodial Parents Party, Equal Parenting. So before we get on with all those interviews, we've got a bit of news that's been happening this week. And it's always nice to have some good news, I suppose. This is some news from America and the Fathers and Families site, where we've previously spoken to Ned Holstein on this program, who's the chairman of the board of Fathers and Families, and they do a lot of good work in the U.S. in this area of families, fathers, parents, and they're reporting a success in California, where. They've succeeded in killing one of the worst family law bills in modern history. Now, that's saying something. This was a bill that was put up by a well-funded advocacy group called Center for Judicial Excellence, supported by the California National Organization for Women. And this bill would have banned parental alienation from being mentioned in any way, shape or form in a California family court. And because of California's tremendous influence in shaping the laws of other states, if this bill had gone through, it would have led to a mushrooming of similarly damaging legislation in all the other states in the US. But fortunately, the good news is that Fathers and Families legislative representative Michael Robertson helped cobble together a coalition of family law professional organizations and experts to oppose the bill, and the bill has effectively been bottled up in the Senate Judiciary Committee, and it will stay there until last week when it actually died. So this is the second time in 2 months that Fathers and Families have been instrumental in defeating a Center for Judicial Excellence bill. You might remember earlier in the year, in June, there was a bill about military fathers being prejudiced by their service overseas for their country. So that's a bit of good news in the States. Now, Ian, I think you've got a couple of interesting stories there for us.
Oh, well, there's one here that's basically just an election fluff in this morning's Telegraph. It made the front page, so we better mention it. Pay cut for Mr. Mums. Sue Dunleavy writes on page 6, men who opt to be the primary carer of their newborn babies will have their parental leave paid at the mother's pay rate, not their own, under the coalition's paid parental leave scheme. So there you go. So that's the opposition. Tony Abbott and crew, basically, they've offered this support for new families and newborn babies, but in the fine print, that they will be paying dads at the mum's rate, which doesn't really strike me as being particularly fair-minded, but that's the way it is. I would say this policy, it doesn't look like the Libs are going to get, the coalition is going to get government anyway, so this is just window dressing, really. We'll probably never hear about this ever again.
Yes, I think from recollection, the government, the Labor Party's proposal for paid parental leave is only for the mothers. So I suppose if the Liberals are offering something for the dads, it's better than nothing.
Well, I guess so. That's better than absolutely nothing.
So, I don't know whether that comes under the good news category or what.
But, oh, just just political fluff, I think, is the category that should stay in. Okay, well, let's get serious here. I've got another one here. Rise in calls to experts about child-on-child sex abuse. This was in this morning's Australian. This is serious. Natasha Robinson has written, child protection advocates are being inundated with phone calls from schools, preschools and childcare centres desperate for advice on how to handle sexually abusive behaviour in children. Now, this is a serious worry. Responding to an Australian Crime Commission report that lifted the lid on a culture of confusion, denial and non-disclosure of sexualised and sexually abusive behaviour in children, the Australian Childhood Foundation said there had been a tenfold increase in demand for its therapeutic services. The foundation runs a program in Victoria for children aged between 7 and 12 years that exhibit problem sexual behaviour, in which social workers and psychologists work with the families and carers of the children. 10 years ago when the program started, it was attracting about 10 referrals a year. Now it attracts more than 150. The Australian Childhood Foundation Chief Executive Joe Tucci said, we've had an increase in number, but even more importantly, we've had an increase in the severity of the behaviour. We are now getting kids referred who are doing penetrative acts against other children using objects. It's very serious behaviour. He said that in about 50% of cases, children had been sexually abused themselves, but in the other half, children had suffered family trauma or exposure to sexually explicit images. So all of this music, all of these ads, all of this marketing to children, sexualizing children, you know, everybody's saying, oh, we're not on a slippery slope, we're on the slide. And Ms. Johnson from the Child Protection Lobby Braveheart said children were inundated with sexually explicit images and messages in the media. Kids are growing up in an X-rated society, she said. There's no safe place for kids anymore where they are not going to be bombarded with adult sexuality. It's in the music, it's on the TV, it's on their phones, it's inescapable, and it's having an effect. So it would appear that all of the sexualization, and especially in music, I mean, I grew up in the 60s, and you know, I want to hold your hand, and now I mean, you get, you know, these songs out there, you know, are you man enough, you know, I want to, you know, I mean, it's pornography, it's musical pornography, and the video clips that come with a lot of it, you know, Beyonce, I mean, yes, yeah, she's incredibly talented, you know, amazingly beautiful woman, but showing that behavior to young children is not healthy, and it's starting to show. Well, we're getting symptoms of a problem, and children are, if they see sexual behaviour on television, well, they're going to imitate it. That's what children do. They imitate the behaviour of adults, and if they are if they're constantly exposed to adult sexuality, well, this is the result. It's happening.
Yes, I think there's a lot pointing to that, and we're seeing the sexualisation of children just about everywhere these days, aren't we?
Well, even in competitions, I mean, they're dressing, you know, little girls up in these really sexy outfits and teaching them to, you know, strut their stuff. I mean, little prepubescent girls, you know, trying to do Marilyn Monroe dances and stuff. I mean, it's just not appropriate. I mean, childhood should be a time of innocence. As parents, it is our duty to protect our child's innocence. We must protect it. It is a valuable, precious thing, a child's innocence. And adults, we must protect it. We shouldn't try to shove all these things down their throat before they're ready for them. It doesn't do them any good. It might be funny to see the reaction of a 6-year-old to Beyonce's latest sexy, or Lady Gaga strutting around semi-naked or something, but it's not having a positive effect on their mental development. It's having a very negative effect.
Yes, these sorts of images are being projected in our advertising as well, and not just in relation to children, but there's also, I think, an increase in the sexism. Just maybe one example might be the Brute aftershave campaign, and in which there's a totally unrealistic depiction of men. Oftentimes, men are now, these days, being presented as being somewhat mentally deficient, I suppose, as much as being they're either, you know, these great heroes or some sort of mental illness.
An idiot. Portrayed as stupid.
I think there's another one where a bloke wonders what being regular is when he, in a cereal commercial featuring comedian Julia Morris, only to be told that he doesn't get it. So you might think... Or there's another ad where the man's love of cars is treated as some kind of male-specific mental illness, with his wife or partner rolling her eyes as he lovingly waxes the hood. We see these sorts of ads all the time, and I think we just need to be sensitised to these and be aware that this is not a real portrayal of men in our society. Just reporting too on a case in the District Court at Ipswich recently. Well, the judgment was delivered on the 22nd of December, 2009, and the background to this case is that there had been a de facto relationship between a couple. In May 2005, proceedings were commenced in the family court concerning the child, but not long after that, the mother procured a domestic violence order be made against the father. And the application for domestic violence contained a number of false statements, including an accusation that the father had been involved or had organised for her to be assaulted in the King George car park after the family court hearing. It also alleged that he'd seen a Dr. Troop, who was a psychiatrist, and that the Dr. Troop had found him to be a violent and compulsive liar, when in fact Dr. Troop had never seen the father. And there was an allegation that an act of violence was witnessed and that he was not willing to endorse the version that was given of the particular incident. And there was also a number of documents that had been forged. Well, the end result of all this was that the mother was sent to jail. It was regarded as a very serious perversion of the course of justice. And I'm interested that the judge said that, as has been observed in a number of cases, the offence of attempting to pervert the course of justice, like perjury, is a crime that strikes at the heart of the administration of justice. And
that's new for a family court sort of situation, isn't it? That they're, you know, that they're even using the J word.
Yes, it's you'd like to see that attitude infiltrate all the other family courts if they're going to do something about the perjury that's committed every day in the family court. This was raised at the recent Lone Fathers Conference, and there seemed to be some confusion between the Attorney General and the Commonwealth Attorney General and the family court as to who is actually responsible for perjury. I'm probably inclined to go with the family court judge, who said that this was a matter for the Attorney General, and that this is something that complaints should be referred to him, and he should enforce it being a criminal matter. But anyway, that's going to be an ongoing campaign, I think, to get perjury recognised. Well, we might go to a break, and we'll be back shortly with our first guest.
I've got to take a little time to think things over. Between the lines, in case I need it when I'm older. Now this mountain I must climb feels like a world upon my shoulder. Clouds I see love shine, it keeps me warm as life grows colder. little time. A little time to look around me. I've got nowhere left to hide. It looks like love has finally found me. In my life, there's been heartache and pain.
They grow so fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child. Dad's in Distress, 1300 853 437.
We're back with Dad's on the Air.
Welcome back to Dad's on the Air. And that was Foreigner singing a song from 1985. It's a good song, and it's a theme song for a group called Youth In Search. So a cheerio to all those at Youth In Search. Now, waiting patiently on the line, now, Sam Page is the Executive Director of Family Relationship Services Australia. Family Relationship Services Australia is the national peak body for family relationship and support services. Are you there, Sam?
Yes, I am.
Oh, thank you for joining us this morning.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Now, Sam, you recently presented at the Lone Fathers Conference, and you're one of the key speakers at that conference. So maybe we can get onto that in a moment. But I notice you're in the news with a couple of things. I'm pleased to see that the Attorney General has advised that the planned funding cuts are now not going to be implemented. It must be good news.
Well, there was a small cut this year won't be implemented. I understand the larger cuts starting from next year are still on the table, but we are taking the change of heart on this year's funding cuts as a positive sign.
Yes, well, that's right. So, I guess you need some support to overturn the planned cuts in this election climate.
Yes, well, I mean, we certainly we'd be very concerned about the impact of cuts because services are already struggling to match demand. There are waiting lists at a lot of the family relationship services, the family relationship centres particularly, and we really want to be able to help people in a timely way. So we don't want to see those waiting lists get any longer.
Yes, and that's, perhaps we might get onto that. That is something that's frequently raised about the family relationship centres as being a problem. Now, I think you participated in the Attorney General's Family Law System conference last week as well. I was wondering if you could tell us what came out of that conference.
I did. Well, look, I think that conference is particularly valuable because it brings people from across the many disciplines that work in the family law system together and gives us an opportunity to have those sort of high-level discussions, if you like, about where some of the pressure points are in the family law system, what's working well and what's not working so well, and how we can get people with different skills and different roles to work together more effectively, and what elements of the system might change to improve the experience of people that are coming into contact with the system. So while each of the sectors, like the family lawyers have a conference and the family relationship services have a conference and the legal assistance services, they get together and have a conference. This is the family law system conference is a bit different because it brings together people from across all of those different groups.
Mm. And there does seem to be a bit of a movement away from the family court towards services such as the FRCs. Is that, are you witnessing that? A movement away from people, you know, going to the family courts to resolve their disputes. You're having great success in the, or you're having some success anyway, in the family relationship centres.
Yes, certainly the major evaluation conducted by the Australian Institute of Family Studies of the 2006 family law reforms indicated that there is a reduction in filings in the family court that has been, the filing numbers have been dropping since 2006, and that's a positive indication that a lot of people are finding resolution outside of the court, and family relationship centres are, and family dispute resolution more generally is certainly a big part of that. We don't necessarily think that everybody should be finding resolution outside the court. You know, there are some people for whom the court is absolutely the place they need to be, and there is a role for the family court, always will be in this service system as far as we're concerned, but the more people who can be assisted to make parenting arrangements without getting into an adversarial situation and without having to pay the cost of a legal fight in the family court, the better.
Yes, I mean, I'd have to agree with you that the more we can reduce the adversarial nature of these resolutions, the better. And I suppose in that context, I'm concerned about some changes that have recently gone through in the child support area, where the child support agency is no longer going to accept what the orders are. If one of the parent breaches the orders, they're going to take it on the basis of the actual night spent with the other parent. And, of course, and they're saying, well, if you don't like that, well, then you've got to go and take out a contravention, which, of course, is going to mean a new certificate from a family, an FDRP, family dispute resolution practitioner, or through one of your services. And is that of concern to you?
I guess it's a very recent change, so it's not something that's being raised yet by either families coming into the services or practitioners working with those families. It certainly could become an issue if we were seeing a number of those cases.
Mm.
It may be that it's a trigger. If court orders are in place but not being complied with, it may be a trigger to another opportunity to work with the family, which might not be such a bad thing.
Mm.
But I can't really comment until we see some of those cases and know, you know, whether that's working in the interests of the families or not.
Yes. I think the change, well, it wasn't signalled at the Lone Fathers Conference, which is itself, I suppose, a concern, that because we had the members of government there and no one mentioned it, but it was, I believe it came in from the 1st of July, although the Child Support Agency is not going just from the 1st of July, they're going right back to when the orders were made. So, just a few areas for concern there that perhaps need to be raised in another forum with the Child Support Agency.
Right, yeah.
But going back to the service you provide, you are the national peak body. Do you able to regulate your members, or what exactly is your role?
No, we don't have a regulation role. I mean, we're excuse me, sorry. We do. Our members are all non-profit community-based organisations that have that are regulated by the government agencies from which they receive funding. So all of the family relationship services receive funding from the Department of Families and Families, Community Services, Housing and Indigenous Affairs, which is a Commonwealth Government department, and that department has a raft of requirements on organisations that are in receipt of that funding. They have to participate in quality audits, external audits every 3 to 5 years and internal audits every year. They have to provide performance data on a monthly basis. They have to comply with rigorous contract requirements, and they have to have things like, you know, robust complaints handling mechanisms and good staff supervision, and staff also in certain roles have have accreditation requirements on them that they have to meet. So it really is the funding body that regulates the providers of services. However, as I said, all our services are, all our member organisations are non-profit community-based organisations. They all have a very strong values base. They're all committed to high-quality service delivery, and we can help them with that. So we help by providing them with information about the latest research findings, the latest developments in practice, in supporting dialogue across the sector about what's working well and what's not working so well and how services can be improved. We also can provide feedback. So if we're hearing from, you know, we work closely with Lone Fathers and with the Single Mothers Council and with the advocacy groups, parent families and parents in Victoria, for example, who will raise issues with us if they're hearing that people are dissatisfied with the services they're receiving or don't understand the services they're receiving, or if there's some way that we can improve service delivery, we'll do that.
Yes, well, the Men's Rights Agency in Brisbane has recently conducted a survey on FRCs, and I'm hoping that when that survey, the results are produced, that will be of interest to you. But one of the things that has come out at a preliminary stage before the actual results are produced is that there is a concern about the close relationship between the FRCs and Relationships Australia, which I think has the lion's share of the contracts. Now, I think the chairman of your body is, in fact, Anne Hollands, is that right?
That's right.
Do you see that there's a potential for any conflict of interest between having her as the chairman and also being Relationships Australia?
No. So just the structure of Relationships Australia is there's an independent organisation in each state and territory that is a Relationships Australia, so Relationships Australia New South Wales, Relationships Australia Victoria, Relationships Australia Queensland. Each of those organisations compete for funding to deliver services and deliver those services as autonomous organisations. They have a national network and they have a national office here in Canberra, but they're not one big organisation. They're eight separate organisations. They are all members of FRSA, as are a number of Anglican organisations, Catholic service providers, organisations that have connections to the Uniting Church or the Baptist Church. About half of our member organisations belong to another national network, so either a church-affiliated national network or Relationships Australia, and about the other half are independent local community organisations that exist and operate in their local community. All of those organisations that belong to FRSA have a vote, and the board of directors of FRSA are voted in by the members. And so Anne, as with anyone else on the board, has stood for election, has been voted by 105 full members of FRSA into that role. It's a very fair and transparent process.
Oh, well, that's good to hear. Yes, but just because I know with Relationships Australia, they have a particular agenda with Jen McIntosh, and I have direct experience of people that don't subscribe to Jen McIntosh view are not welcome at Relationships Australia. Now, is that something that your body could investigate?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean. Each of the RAs, as I say, operate as an independent organisation, so I don't know that there is a national agenda as such. Each organisation makes its own decisions. I know a number of the Relationships Australia providers have embraced the child inclusive practice, that methodology that Jen McIntosh has pioneered and done a lot of research on. They're very enthusiastic at implementing child inclusive practice, and that so are a number of other organisations. That's not unique to Relationships Australia. Lots of other organisations also believe that methodology is very valuable and has a lot to offer. I don't see it as an agenda as such.
Well, I've had some direct experience where it is an agenda, and I suppose another concern is our own Greg Andreessen was involved recently in a survey, in a conference in Perth relating to domestic violence, and apparently Relationships Australia representatives were prohibited from going to the conference, although I believe some of them did turn up without acknowledging where they're from. It seems to be that Relationships Australia are actually laying down some pretty strict guidelines without sort of being open to other influences or perhaps developing their approach. And is that something that your body could investigate?
Certainly, as I said at the Lone Fathers Conference, we're happy to take feedback on any of our member organisations and take that back to them and discuss it with them and see if we can't... We're not a complaints handling body, that's not what we do, but we are happy to facilitate some discussion with providers if there are particular concerns or people feel that they're having a experience that's less than what they'd hoped for. Happy to take that up with them.
Oh, look, that's great, Sam. Of course, as I say, coming out of the Men's Rights Agency survey, I think there will be some issues, and if they could raise it through you, I think, or through your organisation, I think that would be very helpful.
Mm-hmm.
Are you just going perhaps with what your work is? Your primary response is to post-separation disputes. Is that where you see your main role?
No, we work across both the family law system and the family support program. So we are equally, we see ourselves anyway, as equally invested in both assisting families through post-separation and working with families in an early intervention prevention way to strengthen families and enhance parenting capacity. So we're not just dispute resolution, although that is a significant part of the post-separation landscape.
And are you interested in joint parenting? Does your body take a particular view on equal shared time, for instance?
No, we don't have a particular... Well, we made various submissions to both the shared parenting bill when it was first under discussion, and more recently to processes such as the Richard Chisholm's review of family violence in the family court. We don't think that any particular parenting arrangement should be given priority over any others. What we particularly want to do with separating families is to have them consider all the different ways to promote meaningful relationships with both parents. We certainly believe that meaningful relationship with both parents is very important. It's not necessarily about time. We don't... 50-50 is fine, where 50-50 is appropriate and it works for the parents and it works for the children, but there are also lots of other arrangements that can work just as well or be better for either the parents or the children. We want parents to find the best solution for their specific situation and their children.
Yes, because, grandparents have an interest as well, don't they? And they're sometimes forgotten in these arrangements.
That's right. That's right. And 50-50 is hard. I don't think we should underestimate that. It's hard to make it work and to sustain it. And so you don't want people to feel like they've got less than a meaningful relationship because of a particular time split or because children are asking for a change or because they've reached a certain developmental stage or one parent's moved a bit further away and it means a lot of transporting children backwards and forwards. The important thing is the quality of the relationship.
Yes, but when you say that, I think that's almost like code, isn't it, for saying that the when it's not 50-50, that normally means the mother is going to have more than 50, doesn't it?
I think we'll see that change over time. I think what we've got to we've got a long societal tradition of women doing the majority of the child rearing, which is coming to an end, I think, and we're seeing more in intact families as well, much more sharing of parenting and much more different patterns of parents deciding what work hours they will do and what time they will spend with children. And that, I think, is a societal shift, and that will impact more than anything else on the variety of post-separation arrangements that we start to see.
Yes. So when a father does want to have, well, 50-50 or a much greater share, that really should be encouraged, shouldn't it, as far as that shift in society that you're talking about?
Well, what a family dispute resolution practitioner will work with the father and the mother and the children to try and find the best possible arrangement for them.
Okay. So there is less of a reliance on the old every second weekend and half school holidays approach to father time, spending time with his children.
Yes, absolutely. And we wouldn't want that to be given any priority or preference over other arrangements either. Do you know, I think that should be well behind us now. I think we really genuinely want to see people consider all the possibilities and work out arrangements that suit their lifestyle, the needs of their children, and give both parents a sense that they have good quality time, meaningful relationship, whatever that looks like.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. And with the problems with non-compliance, what's generally happens in your experience in this area, or what should happen perhaps?
What we'd like to be able to do is provide a lot more support to families where there's non-compliance with either a court order or a parenting agreement. It's obviously broken down for some reason, and we would like to be able to provide a lot more support and spend time with both the parents trying to work out what's going on and decide whether it's suitable for another family dispute resolution process or as something like a parenting, doing more sort of parenting support work to try and get to the bottom of what the problem is. Because the problem generally isn't the arrangements themselves, it's something underneath that. It's about the relationship between the parents. And we'd like to address those underlying issues. Ideally, what Family Relationship Services want to do is help people get to the nature of relationship and the nature of communication that they can work out parenting arrangements and do shared parenting over the long term.
Yes, I guess it's like we were speaking a few minutes ago about the court system, where you perhaps have to have that last resort of the police or orders from the court. I mean, I suppose that, you know, the end point is putting the person that's contravening the orders in jail as provision under the legislation. But I guess you'd see that as the last resort.
Well, yes, we see it as the last resort because it's not good for children. You know, to have a parent sent to jail and to have the conflict between the two parents escalated to that level is not good for children. So we'd much rather get to the bottom of why one parent is not supporting the arrangements that's in place and try and resolve that.
And you see education as having a role there?
Absolutely.
So how would you get that education program to work?
Interestingly, there was a lot of discussion about this at the recent conference in terms of how much what sort of supports would we like to be able to offer people post-court? So if there has been a court process and the court orders are in place but they're breaking down, what are the range of programs that we'd like to be able to offer? And would those, some of those would be voluntary, some of those might be mandatory. Education would form a big part of it, as well as counselling or therapeutic interventions that are about, getting, as I said, underneath the non-compliance to what are the reasons, what's going on for both parents underneath that. Does one parent feel are they just not recognising the value of the relationship with the other parent, or are they fearful? Is there some logistical issue? What's the underlying cause, and can we resolve that?
Yes, and what are the to get the people giving that counselling? You engage FDRPs in the FRCs, and then there are some FDRPs that are out there working independently. What's the education process for those counsellors or service providers?
Yeah, so FDRPs are a significant part of the workforce, but so are family counsellors. Family counsellors would do a lot of that therapeutic work, particularly before FDR commences and potentially afterwards if parenting agreements break down or people are struggling with parenting agreements. It's the family counsellors that might work with families through that. But FDRPs have to be accredited. They have to be approved by the Attorney General's Department. They have to do a number of core competencies. They need to demonstrate they have a number of core competencies. So they either can demonstrate that through recognition of skills and experience or through doing vocational training. The areas of competence are in family law, understanding the family law system, family violence, knowing family violence, and obviously dispute resolution. There is actually a graduate diploma in family dispute resolution that will be mandatory for all new FDRPs from the 1st of July next year.
Yes, and having done the FDRP course, I don't know if you're the appropriate person to raise it with, but I had great concern about the domestic violence component because it was, I gather it was prepared by the Attorney General. It was a very slick production with good acting, but the content was very slanted to showing that men were the only people that have domestic violence. It was quite an extraordinarily prejudiced production. Is that something that you can you can have a look at and see if it needs to be there need to be some changes made?
Well, content. Excuse me. I'm having a terrible cough today. The content of training courses is actually developed by the training provider, whichever training provider delivered that training. So it wouldn't have been developed by the Attorney General's Department. It would have been developed by the registered training organisation that delivered the training, and so it would be best to take it up with them, I think.
Oh, okay. So that would be, I think it was Uniting Care, I think, in that case. But it was, there was obviously a lot of money spent on the production, but it was, it only presented the men as being violent, and there was one, and it was always the women that were victims, except for one, I think it was a gay couple, and it was the man again being violent towards the gay partner. Which, very, very slanted. Sam, with your organisation, you've got about 150.
Yes.
And is that all those types of organisations, or do you see is your group going to expand? Or
We certainly like to expand. Where we're at the moment is 105 of our organisations are what we call full members, and they're the organisations that are funded under the Family Relationship Services Program, which is all of the family relationship centres, the family dispute resolution services, the children's contact services, the family counselling providers and the relationship education and training providers, as well as a number of specialist programs like programs for humanitarian entrance and men and family programs. So that's a specific program funded by the Commonwealth Government, and all the organisations that have a funding agreement with the Commonwealth to deliver those services are currently members of FRSA. We then have about 45 associate members, which are other organisations that don't have a funding contract to deliver those programs but do have an interest in this area of work, or deliver similar types of programs funded either by Commonwealth or state governments. So we'd like to keep expanding and growing that associate membership base, and there may be a time where we redefine the full member, associate member categories.
Well, that's good to hear. That's a positive way forward. And we're speaking with Samantha Page, who is the Executive Director of Family Relationship Services Australia. Sam, is there any message you'd like to get out there to the parents who might come to use your services?
Oh, what a good question. I think our biggest message is that it's okay to get some help, that what we really want people to see family relationship services as something that are good for them, that they're welcome anytime, that whenever things start to get a bit wobbly, whether you've just separated or whether you've been separated for years, whether you've had court orders or parenting agreements in place, whenever you think there might be some value in getting some help, please do that. You know, come in, talk to somebody. They're very welcoming places, very safe places to go, and we want to encourage families to use them as much as they need them.
And Sam, we touched briefly on the delays at present, and again, I've had some direct experience of this. There is a detailed process involved in getting before to a mediator. I'm just wondering if there's any possibility of streamlining things, because literally it can take 6 months to actually get some sort of resolution, and by that stage, you know, the problem's either irreparably damaged or it's gone away or whatever. Do you see any ways of cutting down those delays?
Well, initially, the model of practice did get people in front of mediators more quickly, but what the experience has been with many, many more people coming into family dispute resolution is that it's the time spent with parents before the mediation session actually happens that can be the most helpful and contribute to getting a better outcome from mediation itself. So mediation has become a smaller component of the family dispute resolution process, and the work done with parents beforehand, individually, particularly, but also in group sessions around discussing how children respond to separation. A lot of people come in, they're very fearful of the impact of separation on the children just per se, and they perhaps don't realise that it's the conflict between them and the ex-partner that is most likely to impact on the children rather than the separation itself. Things like that, the education process that happens, the parenting support that happens, the dialogue they have, clarifying what it is they want for the children long term, that can lead to a much better outcome from family dispute resolution. And so the tendency in practice has been to spend more time rather than less with people before mediation. However, if people have been through that process and the parenting agreement has broken down for some reason and they're coming back in for another mediation session, there's often not the need to go through that again. You know, that can be a much quicker process. Mm.
I see. Yeah, so it's actually part of the design. I think perhaps that message isn't getting out there because there are complaints about delays. But that's an interesting approach that perhaps you get the benefit even before the mediation.
Well, so the delays that we're concerned about are the delay between initial contact and first appointment.
Yes.
So there are some services that just can't see you for 6 or 8 weeks after you make the first contact with them, and we don't like that. Our preference, good practice, is to be able to provide an appointment within 2 weeks of first contact with the service, and we'd love every service to have that capacity. Mm. The ones that don't because they don't have the resources and they're swamped by demand, and there's never been really a thorough review of whether the services were funded at the level of capacity they need to be in order to meet community demand. We would like to see the funding increasing in the areas where it needs to increase, because we'd like to be able to say that every service can see anyone who contacts them within 2 weeks. That would be ideal.
Yes, well, again, my experience in Sydney was that it would be 2 weeks before you get a phone call back, and then it would be another couple of weeks before there'd be a discussion about mediation, and then you had to do a course, and then it was decided that it would go to a telephone mediation anyway, and so it seemed like a couple of months had gone by without anything happening.
Yes.
That's the bad side of it.
That initial delay is certainly the thing we'd most like to address quickly, and Sydney is particularly fraught in terms of the demand has just completely overwhelmed a lot of the family relationship centres in Sydney.
Yep.
And I understand, you know, it's the same with the court registries. There's very long delays there, long delays for legal assistance services. It's across the board. I think the investment in services just isn't keeping up with the population of Sydney and the rate at which it's growing.
And, of course, with young children, the delay is much more important even than with older children. 6 months is a big part of a life of a young child, isn't it?
Well, that's right. And services will generally try to support families to have contact arrangements in place during that time. It's not generally that they don't that they they want people going 6 months with all contact suspended or no relationship between the between one of the parents and the children. That's not ideal at all.
Yeah. Oh, look, that's great. We've been speaking with Samantha Page, Executive Director of Family Relationship Services Australia. Sam, thank you very much for coming on the show today. It's been great to talk to you and get the inside information on a lot of those areas, which are some of them are causing concern out in the community, I'm sure. So thank you once again, and we wish you all the best with the Family Relationship Services.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity. Happy to come on any time.
Oh, thank you very much. Okay. Thanks, Sam.
Cheers. Bye-bye. Bye.
They got married early, never had no money. Then when he got laid off, they really hit the skids. He started up his drinking, then they started fighting. He took it pretty badly, she took both the kids. She said, I'm not standing by to watch you slowly die. So watch me walking at the door, at the door, at the door. She said, chubby Jack, I'm walking at your fucking door. She went to her brother's, got a little bower. He went to the nunnery, he stayed about a year. Then he wrote a letter, said, I wanna see ya. She thought it sounded better, she sent him up the fair. He was riding through the cane in the pouring rain on a limping to her door, to her door, to her door, to her door. His heart was singing like a low-down guitar. He came in on a Sunday, every muscle aching, walking in slow motion, like he'd just been hit. Did they have a future? Would he know his children? Could he make a picture and get them all to fit? He was shaking in his seat, riding through the streets in a silver top. Her shaking in his seat, riding through the streets in a silver top. To her door, to her door, to her door, to her door.
They grow so fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child.
What do you care? It's not like you were ever there anyway.
Dads in Distress meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437 or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air. Welcome back to Dads on the Air this 27th day of July 2010. And our next guest is particularly relevant in view of the coming election. And I'm very pleased he was able to make time for us when I'm sure he's flat out working on the election. But our guest is John Flanagan. John, are you there?
Yeah, hi, how are you going?
Well, thank you. John is the Deputy Registered Officer of the Non-Custodial Parents Party, Equal Parenting. And John, how's the campaign going?
Well, so far we've been very busy. This is our fourth federal election. We have candidates so far in three House of Representative seats and also in the Senate in New South Wales. We normally have a few more. Nominations don't close until the 29th of July, which is this coming Thursday, so we're hopeful of having some more candidates. But at the present time, I've got myself in Cunningham, which is in Wollongong. Wayne Hartman is running in Throsby, which is around Shell Harbour. Brendan Hall is in McEwen, which is in Seymour in Victoria. And we have Andrew Thompson and Roland Foster are our candidates in the Senate for New South Wales.
Oh, good. So for people like me, we do have, even if we're not in either of those seats that you mentioned, we've got an opportunity through the Senate to put a vote in for the non-custodial parents party.
At least in New South Wales, in previous elections, we've had candidates in at least four states, but so far we've only been able to organise New South Wales, but we're certainly looking at the other states before the 29th of July.
And for people who want to come to the party, as it were, that would be interested in standing on behalf of the Non-Custodial Parents Party, what should they do, John?
Well, they can either contact me through our email address, which is ncpp@xisle.info, or they can ring me direct on my mobile, which is 0415 899 574.
Great. And if they are interested, they I imagine they'd have to put up a deposit.
Yes, unfortunately, we're not that financial sort of thing, so the candidates would have to raise their own deposit. For the House of Representatives, the deposit is $500, and for the Senate, it's $1,000. Now, in the Senate, we need two candidates in each state so that we can run what they call above the line, because 94% of voters vote above the line rather than below the line. So if we are below the line, you just get lost in the numbers of candidates that are there.
Okay, so if you with the two candidates, that would classify you as a party rather than an individual, I guess.
Exactly, that's what happens. Yeah, so that people can just put their one in the little box above the line.
And once you've paid your $1,000 for the Senate or $500 for the House of Reps, how many voters do you need before you get it back, as it were?
You need 4% to be able to get it back, but I must say, realistically, we will not get our deposits back, because our party is a single-issue party, and we're only targeting at the maximum 10% of the electoral population, so the chances of getting that 4% is fairly remote. But the main thing is that we make a statement to the government that we're not happy with what they're doing at the present time.
Yes, now on that issue, you have a full range of policies, I believe. I wonder if you could tell us what some of those policies are.
Yeah, for sure. What we've got is our main policy, of course, is the child support and family law policy. We do have a full range of policies on other issues, but just with the family law policy, the main issues that we are concerned about are equal parenting, fairer courts, and better child support.
Okay, and now I think you may have heard some of our last interview with Sam Page.
That's correct, yeah.
Did you have any comment on what she was saying as far as the family relationships?
Yeah, for sure. Like, I fully support the efforts of Sam Page with her Relationship Services Australia, but it is of interest that the government has recently taken $46 million away from the family relationship centres and transferred it to the legal aid. Now, this can only be seen as taking money away from mediation and putting it into litigation services, which is really what this is, which is causing the main problem. The lawyers are one of our major problems in the family law issues, and the government is pushing more money into litigation and taking away from mediation. So I think that it just shows you what they stand for. They don't stand for trying to sort the problem out. They just want to put money into solicitors' pockets.
Yes, I mean, there seems to be an encouragement to develop the adversarial nature of it, which is really, you'd have to say, is against working against the interests of certainly the children, but of everyone in this, except for the professionals involved in it, isn't it?
That's correct. And Sam touched upon one issue. She said that the court orders are often suspended between the initial hearing and the final hearing. Now, we find that very often the judge, at the end of the day, he makes orders based on status quo. Now, once the status quo has been established, there's no contact, it's very hard to re-establish contact after the final hearing. So a lot of the judges, they just go along with what's been established from the initial hearing, which is to suspend the court orders and have no contact. So the situation is not anywhere near providing the solutions that we need.
Yes, your party is pushing for equal shared time, I gather.
That's correct. Yeah. Shared parenting is often misconstrued, but we try to define it as the rebuttable presumption of equal time shared parenting to make sure that there's no misconceptions in the word shared parenting.
It's extraordinary the way the misunderstanding of that concept, and I can only think that there's perhaps an agenda of people to make sure that people don't understand what's being presented. But what you're saying is that there's a rebuttable presumption. So you start off with equal parenting. If for some reason there's violence or there's drunkenness or there's some other reason that would make you an unsuitable as a parent, you raise those and you prove those in court, and then an action is taken.
Well, the key word there is proved. At the present time, you don't have to prove anything. All you have to do is make an allegation, and that is sufficient to have court order suspended. Now, we maintain that you must prove these allegations before you can suspend the court orders or do what other action is required. We do not go along with family violence. We do not go along with sexual abuse, but we maintain you have to prove it first. At the present time, one parent only has to make the allegation, and that sticks.
Yes. So if there were this presumption, now that would be the starting point. Now,
correct.
I think there's also a misunderstanding between what equal shared responsibility is and equal shared parenting.
Definitely, and that's what happened when the laws were changed in 2006. There was a lot of media publicity put out by the government that they actually used the words rebuttable presumption, but they used it in connection with shared parental responsibilities, and that caused a lot of confusion. Shared parental responsibilities is a legal term, basically meaning that you can choose the child's religion, you can choose where they go to school, you can get school reports and other issues like that, but it doesn't mean that the child can live with either parent or both parents, as the case may be. So just because you've got a rebuttal presumption of shared parental responsibilities, it doesn't mean that you have extra time with the child. And normally, as you would know, once the child lives with one parent on a full-time basis, that parent makes the main decisions anyway, effectively. So therefore, the rebuttal presumption of shared parental responsibilities does not have as much weight as what the government is maintaining.
Yes, I mean, I think the perhaps one benefit coming out of it is there's a misunderstanding that the shared parental responsibility was the same as shared time. So if people are thinking that and act accordingly, I suppose that could be a beneficial effect. But I see one of the main things is that it might put a brake on the relocations, that if someone's going to relocate, it's almost impossible to have equal shared responsibility, isn't it?
That's right, yeah. And even more so, if we implement the rebuttable presumption of equal time shared parenting, it makes it even more difficult for one parent to move away with the children, because they have to have equal time with both parents. But the way it is at the present time, that if one parent has every second weekend contact and the other parent is the custodial parent, it's relatively easy for the custodial parent to move away with the children. And once that happens, of course, then contact is lost.
Yes, and well, for those people who are familiar with parental alienation, the relocation is almost written in the instructions book, that it's just very common as one of the elements of parental alienation, the one of the parents moves away.
Yeah, that's correct, because we often see that one of the main problems is revenge, and to get revenge, one parent moves away with the children to try and hurt the other parent. Now, if we have the rebuttable presumption of equal time shared parenting, that would not occur.
So that was a bill put up by Senator Fielding at the time of the 2006 changes. Is that the same sort of thing that you'd like to see put up again, the Senator Fielding bill? That's correct, for sure.
Senator Fielding actually had a health problem at the time, and he couldn't push it, or try to push it through, but it didn't have the support of the major parties in any case, so it would not have been passed through Parliament. But we do support the bill that Senator Fielding proposed, yes.
And, just coming back to that election again, John, are you directing preferences from your party?
Yes, unfortunately, we would like to not to preference either major parties, but the way our electoral system is that we have to end up having preferences flow to the major parties. But what we do is we preference the minor parties first, and then eventually, that down towards the end of the ballot paper, we do then preference the Liberal Party and the Labor Party next, and we preference the Green Party last, because the Green Party are actually an anti-father party who prefer to see their fathers being hurt rather than try to have them see this, have the father see their children, yeah?
Yes, it's, and I think there are elements of that in the Labor Party as well, but...
Oh, definitely, yeah, for sure. The Labor Party has a lot of members who feel much the same way, and I can nominate some if you wish, but there's very many in the Labor Party who would like to see fathers having no contact at all.
Well, perhaps a couple spring to my mind. Who were the ones you were thinking of?
Well, I was thinking of Tanya Plibersek, Nicola Roxon, Jenny George, who is not running this time, also Jenny Macklin, the Prime Minister herself.
I was coming to her.
Gillard is a member of what they call the Emily's List, which is a pro-feminist group of Labor Party politicians. So all those members I've listed are part of the Emily's List, which are really an anti-male, pro-feminist group, which I believe is not helping our cause at all.
Yes, I wasn't aware she was on the Emily's List. Well, there have been suggestions that that the father should have an equivalent list. There's even a name given for it, but I can't remember it now, but an Emily's List for fathers.
Yeah, I think we really need politicians that don't support either males or females. As long as they support the children seeing both parents, I think that's the main issue. Oh. We don't need a pro-fathers group. We don't need a pro-mothers group. We need a group that will have the children seeing both parents, because the kids, as you know, need both parents when they grow up. You know, so... But the government doesn't seem to see it that way.
Yeah, look, I couldn't agree more with you, John, and I think the pendulum has swung too far one way.
Maybe
time's gone by, it was too far the other way, but we should all be aiming to get to that middle ground, which is going to be for the benefit of the children.
Well, basically what we want is we want the government's interference to stop, and we want the parents to make the decisions, not the bureaucracy and the various government departments deciding what time we should have with our children.
Mm. Now, just going back to this, that equal shared responsibility, I mean, does it mean anything? Because, as you say, I mean...
Effectively, it doesn't, because once you have custody of the children, you make the decisions, although it says in the legislation that both parents have an equal responsibility. In practice, it doesn't happen.
Mm.
Yeah, that's logical.
Unfortunately, yes. I mean, how on earth would you enforce it? You've got to go back to, back to contraventions.
I know of people who have put in 30 and 40, even 50 applications for contraventions, and they've all been unsuccessful. So the contravention issue is not a solution.
No. We're speaking with John Flanagan, who is the Deputy Registered Officer of the Non-Custodial Parents Party, Equal Parenting. John, I wonder if you could hold on just for a moment. We might have a short break and we'll come back to you.
Yeah, definitely, yeah, for sure.
Great. Thanks, John. Talk to you in a moment.
Thank you.
So many times today, and I guess it's all true what your girlfriends say. But you don't ever want to see me again, and your brother's gonna kill me, and he's 6 feet ten. I guess you call it cowardice, but I'm not prepared to go on like this. I can't stand losing. I can't stand losing. I can't stand losing.
So fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child.
What do you care? It's not like you were ever there anyway.
Dads in Distress meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437 or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back. With Dads on the Air.
Welcome back to Dads on the Air, this 27th of July 2010, and we're speaking with John Flanagan, Deputy Registered Officer of the Non-Custodial Parents Party, Equal Parenting. John, it would seem to me that you've got a big electorate, or, I mean, every second person you know, they're either involved in family law, or their family, or their boss, or their someone. Everyone seems to know someone who's been affected by it.
That is correct, but I often have people contact me by phone with various issues, and it might be family law, it might be child support, and I ask them who they voted for, and they say, oh, we voted Labor, we voted Liberal, we voted Green Party. And I said, well, why are you voting for those? And they tell me the various issues. And I said, well, why don't you vote for us? We're the party that's involved with families. The other parties do not have any proper family policies, and the Green Party, they do not have a family policy at all. And I find that is the our real problem, is that the voters themselves have to vote for parties themselves, like our party. Otherwise, they get the issues such as family law and child support get lost in with the mainstream of the politics.
Yes, I mean, it is such a major issue for so many people.
For sure. What's more important? Is families more important, or is work choices or the environment or population growth more important? I believe families is the most important issue of all the issues that people should be thinking about for this election. Mm-hmm. Yet, they then turn around and vote for the other parties, which I find is one of our problems, because if people gave us enough votes, the politicians would soon change their tune. At the present time, they just ignore family issues because they think that the electorate is not concerned with it.
Mm. Well, we've got Senator Fielding, but unfortunately Senator Fielding seems to be more involved in stunts and taking rather odd positions in a number of areas that I think in some ways it's probably damaged the credibility of the family movement.
Well, I think that Senator Fielding got in. Our preferences actually helped to elect him in 2004. But he started out as being very supportive, but towards the end he has not been as supportive as what one would hope for. But I think that the Family First will probably not have a senator after this election anyway, because the way the preferences go.
I think for people who are supporters of your party and for families in general, from my observation, it's the Liberal Party that is actually doing things. And Senator Brandis spoke at the Learn Fathers Conference in Canberra recently, and he was very supportive of fathers' issues.
Yes, I actually attended the Learn Fathers Conference as well, but I didn't go on that particular day. But I've actually spoken to Senator Brandis before that, and what he said was, look, we'll fix things after the election. That's all well and good, but after the election, I find it is a little bit disconcerting because do you trust politicians? and that's the real problem. They don't tend to try and sort the problem out before the election or during their term. They just said it's always afterwards.
Yeah.
And I think that that's where the mining companies, for example, are finding with their mining tax, they're starting to think twice about it because they've been told, yeah, it'll be all fixed up afterwards. Well, I wouldn't trust these politicians.
So it's not really a part of the Liberal Party policy, or not a major part at this stage?
Well, no, it's not at all. It's not part of their policy at all. The last time we heard something positive was back in 2003 when John Howard said that the children should see both parents. And since that time, 7 years ago, we haven't heard a thing from either the Liberal or Labor Party in that respect. Perhaps Albie Schultz has been positive in that regard, but he's a one, you know, he's a one-person band. All the rest of the politicians don't seem to care about the issues because basically they don't see that there's any votes in it. And that's why we need the people who are concerned with these issues to at least vote for the vote for our party, because realistically, we are not going to get elected because we haven't got a big enough electoral pull. But at least show that this issue is an important issue by giving us their first preference so that the politicians can see that these issues are important, because the only thing the politicians worry about is votes. They don't worry about anything else.
Yes, I mean, I think we need to get that message out. There are some friendly politicians. I mean, even in the Labor Party, I know John Murphy, for instance, was in Lowe. I think he's now standing for Reid. But
yep.
He's been supportive over the years, and certainly on the Liberal side, Senator Brandis is one, but I think there are a few others that are...
Roger Price has been supportive, but Roger Price is not running this time for Chifley. I'm not, and John Murphy certainly has been supportive when he was the parliamentary secretary. But there are very few politicians that really support our issues.
And John, how did the Non-Custodial Parents Party come to be?
It was formed in 1998 by Andrew Thompson, who is our Senate candidate for New South Wales. Andrew was concerned about the very issues that we've been talking about, and he formed a political party, which is 12 years ago now. At the first federal election they contested, we had 26 candidates standing for Parliament. So we tried to show the politicians that these issues are important. But unfortunately, so far, the numbers of votes we have received has not been enough to change the minds of the politicians, and in actual fact, a lot of the problems have been getting worse.
I mean, another aspect of this is getting the branches on side, and perhaps getting people to sign up. And it's a whole question of motivation, isn't it? How do you get people motivated to get out and do something?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, that's the real issue. Is motivation. There's also having money to advertise as well. It's very hard to compete with the major parties. At the last federal election, both the Liberal and Labor Party spent $40 million each advertising their policies. Now, we've got obviously nothing like that sort of money to spend on campaigning and advertising. So they have a start before we even get off the ground. So that's one of the real issues, is the fact is they get the media coverage and we don't.
Yes. Now, for going back to where we started with candidates, I understand the party can help out a little bit with printing costs, so that's...
Oh, yeah, for sure, definitely, yeah, for sure. We help out. We have a local printer here that helps us out as well, sort of thing. So he prints all our leaflets for distribution, and, yeah, for sure. But the main thing is that we'd like to have candidates in all states. In the previous two elections, in 2004 and 2007, we actually had candidates in four states, so which gives us a widespread, so that people have the opportunity to vote for our issues, and that's what we're doing, is providing that opportunity.
So, and at this stage, you've just got New South Wales and Victoria, did you say, in this election?
Just New South Wales and Victoria. In the past, we've had Queensland, New South Wales, Victoria and Western Australia, but we've only been able to organise the two states at present. But we still have until Thursday, lunchtime Thursday, to finalise the nominations.
Yeah. Oh, well, look, let's hope you get a flood of last-minute interest.
Yeah, sure, because we've got five candidates. We had 10 last time, so we'd like to try and at least get 10 candidates,
yeah. Okay, John, well, have you got a policy speech or anything you'd like to tell our listeners?
Well, as I said, we stand for three issues: equal parenting, fairer courts, and better child support. Our policies can be found on the internet. The website is ncpp.xisle.info. And people can find our policies, both for family law and also our general policy statements as well.
And find out a little bit about the party and...
And find out about the history, our voting preferences, how they can donate, how they can join, and any other issues that they may think that they need.
Well, look, this is all in a great cause. And we're speaking with John Flanagan, who's a Deputy Registered Officer of Non-Custodial Parents Party, Equal Parenting. John, we wish you the very best of luck in the election, and we can only hope that people take an interest in what you're promoting and that it's a successful day for you.
Okay, well, thanks so much anyway, and thanks for the opportunity of being on the radio program.
Thanks for coming on, John. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay, thank you. Okay, bye for now.
Bye.
Sand, but the waves didn't understand and watched your image from the shore. I guess they never saw. I love you. And as the tide moved up the beach, it took our path within its reach, wiping our footprints from the sand. It just did not understand. But now that summertime is gone, and I know I must move on, I feel the cold wind in my face. It drives me from the place. I love you. As I pack my bag to leave, it's only now you can see I'm leaving. When I look into your eyes, I wonder what's gone wrong with me, to wanna leave you, to have to go away so desperately. Can I tell you that it's not that I don't want to stay, but a part of me will die if I don't go away. Your tearful smile haunts me as I lie asleep in my bed. I can't shake it from my mind. It runs too deep in my head. I don't want you to cry, but the time I need you most is when I have to say to you goodbye. Goodbye, my love. Goodbye. Goodbye. With my quest, and no one ever guessed I love you.
But now the past engulfs your touch. It sealed doors, they hide so much. Forever. When I look into your eyes, I wonder what's gone wrong with me. To wanna leave you, to have to go away so desperately. How can I tell you that it's not that I don't want to stay? But a part of me will die if I don't go away. Your cheerful smile haunts me as I lie asleep in my bed. I can't shake it from my mind. It runs too deep in my head. I don't want you to have to see me cry. But the time I need you most is when I have to say to you goodbye. Goodbye, my love. Goodbye. Goodbye, goodbye, goodbye.
About out of time on this 27th day of July 2010. Just a word for people that were listening a few weeks back. We spoke with Dr. Richard Warshak, who's the author of Divorce Poison, and he's put out a new DVD called Welcome Back Pluto. Anyone that is interested in the DVD, get in touch with us here at the station at www.dadsontheair.net. And I can hear the music starting, which means...
That's right. It means we're just about all over, Bill. Another show done.
So, from all of us here, it's Bill Cable from Mediate Now and
Ian Purdy from ianpurdy.com
and Phil York from Dads in Distress.
We wish you all the best for this week. Stay tuned now. It's
Country Bob.
Country Bob, who's told us he's become a grandfather yet again for the 11th time. He's got his cricket team. We wish him all the best and good luck for the show today in Country On. So until next week, it's goodbye from us.
We're here cause we care. We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're dads on the air. We're dads on the air.